Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I'm John Batchelor with James Scott, the author of Black Snow, Curtis LeMay, The Firebombing of Tokyo, and The Road to the Atomic Bomb. The poorest sections of Tokyo are on fire in a firestorm that Tokyo has never seen before and might never actually happen again. This is a unique event in human history. However, back in Guam, Curtis LeMay, who launched these 325 bombers, and everyone on the Marianas and also back in Washington is waiting for results. As James tells us, they expected up to 70% casualties. James, you provide a human scene. LeMay can't sleep, and he and a colleague go for a couple of Coca-Colas from his Quonset hut. They finally get word that there's light flak. What is their first understanding of the raid and how it's going?
You know, and LeMay is sort of always kind of this figure, you know, this sort of reserved guy, you know, and he admits he couldn't sleep this mission. And so he doesn't, he lingers in the operations center. And then he's just stressed out. He knows that one way or another, his whole career is going to be defined by what happens on this night, either by disaster or success. And so it's a lot riding on him. And so he does, he connects with his, the press official for the 21st Bomber Command, who's in there kind of waiting to see what the results are so that he can release the stories that reporters have put together. And so LeMay says, "Let me get you a Coke." And so they jump in his car, head over to his tent, and they grab some Cokes and they sit there. And LeMay's just totally distracted. He's rattling off about what his experience was like in India and everything. He's doing everything he can to distract him and to kill time till they get back to the operations hut. And then the first reports start coming in that there's no flak, there's not much fighter opposition, that essentially the planes have gotten in and gotten their bombs on target. And he feels that first sense of relief then, because all the expectation that they were going to get 70% of them would be shot down or whatnot, he's not hearing that. And so his calculated gamble has been successful. And so his mood improves. And then this is amplified over the next every few minutes, more reports are coming in. They're now describing big fires on the ground. You know, each one's amplifying, it's improving on the previous one. And he knows he's not going to get a real sense of it till they get the first photographs the following day. But he knows pretty early on the mission's been successful.
Saturday morning, a doctor named Kubota, an Imperial Japanese Army doctor, is awake and ready for his mission at 3:40 a.m. to go into the districts that have been bombed. He surprisingly approaches this, not understanding what he's seeing at first. James provides the images that are impossible to believe, but here they are. Bodies floating in the rivers. He couldn't tell whether they were logs or people. Bodies that are stripped of clothing that are pink, as if he compares them to lobsters. Piles of remains. He can't tell where the people are, where they start and where they stop, because they're melted together. He finds some people holding hands outside of that at school where the Shizuko Nishio is inside, and they don't open the door for fear of the firestorm. He finds things he's never seen before, James, and it's helpful to have a professional see this. This exceeded all understanding of what the B-29s or the Americans or anyone could do on Earth at this time. This is pre-atomic bomb. Is that correct, James? How to see this?
It is. No, I mean, look, this thing by sunrise the next morning reveals that Tokyo is an apocalyptic wasteland. I mean, it's block after block, mile after mile, reduced to rubble and ash. And these fires burn with such an intensity that by daybreak, they burn themselves out. There's literally nothing left to burn. And so, and when you look at the photographs afterwards, you see a handful of chimneys on the horizon, and that's it. because that's all that's left of a factory or a bathhouse or whatnot is just this little bit of masonry that was used in it. And so in that next morning, as the sun first rises, it's gray because there's so much ash and haze in the sky that one of the survivors said it looked like the moon was rising, not the sun. And so this is what Kubota is coming into. You know, he's coming in with his ambulance unit as a rescuer. And he literally describes at one point that the fire had burned with such an intensity that there's nothing left at all. I mean, it's just like everything's vanished. And so he ends up at Hanjo High School, and his job is to set up an emergency aid center there. And so he is really the first line of rescue defense and trying to treat people. And of course, what ultimately happened is, I mean, in a lot of these areas, people died. Most of them died. So the types of injuries he's treating are some of them, a lot of them are smoke issues and inhalation issues, some shrapnel issues and things like that from anti-aircraft fire. But I mean, you know, so much of the reality is most of the people there have died.
Yes, he's looking at a landscape that is then windswept. So you don't even see the buildings. The ashes have been blown away.
Yeah.
New York Times, when they get word of this, what has happened, something new in Tokyo. City's heart gone is the headline. James provides some headlines. Evening World Herald, hellish sea of fire engulfs Tokyo. San Diego Union, havoc wrecked by superforts. It's important to include the politics of this moment. The American people are exhausted. The Japanese are fighting on beyond reason, because there is no hope of doing anything but dying in place, as they've done in Iwo Jima, as they're now doing in Okinawa, where tens of thousands of Japanese civilians kill themselves thinking that the Americans will, surrendering to the Americans is unacceptable. The American public has been led to believe that all tools are necessary. And yet, James, there are those who hesitate. We've now walked from strategic bombing to my understanding, James, this is the worst firebombing that ever happened on the face of the earth. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's worse than Dresden. It's worse than Hamburg. It absolutely is. I mean, four times as many people died in Tokyo as at Dresden. And everybody talks about Dresden as the symbol of airborne horror, when Tokyo really is far, far worse.
Dresden is the model we have all these decades later. But James gives us some details here. I know it's numbing, but it's almost 16 square miles burned to nothing.
Yeah.
And 105,000 dead. That's a post-war estimate. They underestimated it first, far more than all the rest of the firebombing. But we need to go on, because LeMay's success, as the Air Force believes it, doesn't mean the war is surrendering. And a note about Hirohito. I don't know if it's the next day or soon after. He rides around in his Mercedes to view the remains. Is it the next day? Is it Saturday? Is that several days later, Jay?
It's several days later. It's about a week later. He comes out, and it's the first time he's actually left the palace since October. And so he comes out. He spends less than an hour outside of the city, sees the ashes and then the ruin, sees the empty faces and expressions of the survivors out there, and then goes right back into his compound.
Is that when he says we need one more victory, or did he say that beforehand?
He was saying that kind of all along, and that's kind of a self-serving idea, because at the end of the day, what Hirohito and his aides wanted was they wanted a better position at the surrender table, at the bargaining table. And they thought that if they could have one more victory, then they would be able to dictate terms. And of course, the terms they want is the protection of the royal family and the emperor. And so, you know, he wants to be able to hang on to his throne. And so they're desperately saying, well, we can get one more victory. But of course, there are no victories to be had. The defeat in Manila, the defeat in Iwo Jima, the defeat in Okinawa, the defeat in Leyte Gulf. I mean, there is no victory. There's just punishment for the Japanese people.
And the least among them, too. We're not talking about prosperity at any point in their lives. These are poor people.
Exactly. I mean, this burden of this falls on the poorer districts of Tokyo, and their leadership allows it to happen, allows it to continue to happen through the summer of 1945, while they hold on to this unrealistic idea that Japan can get one more battlefield victory.
Yes. Back at Guam with Curtis LeMay, I have March 16th, the attack on Kobe, firebombing. March 18th, Nagoya, firebombing. We go on to continue the fighting into April 13th, with LeMay is demanding more crews for more sorties. They actually run out of napalm. They run out of it. And LeMay is then designated to fight alongside the Navy because they need airfields destroyed because they're bending under the kamikaze attack. Remember, this is war end. Nothing's neat here. We're emphasizing the firebombing, however, because it stands out all these decades later, James, reading your book, it stands out as the thing that's different than all the other cities because those cities seem to have been heavily evacuated after Tokyo.
Exactly. And that's one of the things. Japan just fails to take the potential threat of firebombing seriously, which is astonishing considering they had seen what had happened to German cities. So they don't make any real effort to create fire breaks through the city, to evacuate non-essential personnel, other than a handful of elementary schoolers, third through sixth graders. They leave the city full of people. And so after the fire raid on Tokyo, Japan begins to step it up. They give people tickets to get on trains to head to the countryside. They start cutting fire breaks through cities. And you do see a mass migration of people outside of Japan's major cities as word spreads about what happened to Tokyo.
Yes. Into April, the fire Tokyo, they returned to Tokyo again April 13th. These are my notes. James is very careful reporting. 350 B-29s for 3 hours over the parts of Tokyo that actually have warehouses and manufacturing. They're secondary explosions, which we've learned to associate with weapons. However, through May, Nagoya, Tokyo, the major cities, by the end of May, he doesn't have any major cities anymore, so he moves on to the secondary list. Everybody's asking, what about the atomic bomb? What about the atomic bomb? It is surprising to me, in reading through James's reporting, that the atomic bomb is just another bomb of a firebombing nature from the point of view of the people who were alive at the time who didn't know what atomic weapons were.
And it's important to remember, we didn't actually have a working weapon until July 16, 1945 with the Trinity test. So up until that moment, the atomic bomb is a theory. And so we get confirmation that morning that the bomb works. And then that changes that in-game calculus. But by July 16th, LeMay's already burned. You know, all of Japan's major cities have been destroyed largely at that point. He's onto the secondary cities he's worked through. And he's really getting ready to move into moving into tertiary cities. I mean, cities that are populations of about 35,000 people. So he's doing all this incredible heavy lifting with conventional flame weapons before the atomic bomb's even tested.
And a note here, June and July, there is no resistance from the ground. I take it that there's hardly an air force. The fighters are not coming up anymore. Any aircraft is not operating anymore.
Exactly. And he's moved because Japan had moved so much of its anti-aircraft fire around Tokyo and Nagoya. And by the time those cities are destroyed and he's moving on, his forces are spreading out over so many smaller cities. I mean, they're hitting four cities a night that Japan can't defend them. And so that early fear, you see a change in morale among the American airmen who were initially terrified of these operations, you know, as they've suddenly realized that, hey, Japan's not even defending the skies anymore. And so the missions get far safer for them and far easier for them in the latter part.
Carl Spatz is brought in to command the U.S. Army Air Force in the Pacific. Arnold has made the decision not to give it LeMay, whom he sees as a warfighter, as a man who conducts operations, not as a big thinker or a big general commanding. LeMay doesn't object. LeMay, it's his personality. I think of him at Ohio State working all night at the steel mill and sleeping through his first class. He's a very practical man. He doesn't have what is understood as a personality who takes insult. He just keeps working.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, of course, he's a pretty low-ranking general compared to Spots and others. I mean, he's only a two-star general. And Arnold needed someone that had four stars that could rival the senior Navy leaders and whatnot and be able to sort of elbow in and be able to have that gravitas. And LeMay didn't have it. He's 38. He's a two-star. And quite frankly, he's best suited for, you know, literally for that command level strategic attacks and whatnot. Spots is more the politician and the leader.
Final detail about August 6, 1945. Does LeMay know about the bomb before it's dropped?
Oh, yes. He's brought in pretty early on. He has to help set up the operations for the 509th composite on Tinian. He meets with Leslie Grove back in Washington. So he's brought in on it all. He has this great quote, though, because he says, even with his engineering background, he didn't quite grasp the nature of the bomb. He says, I knew it was going to be a big bang. I just didn't know how big. And so, but there's some professional jealousy there. You know, LeMay, and to his credit, I mean, the only reason Hiroshima exists as a target is because LeMay had previously been ordered to hold back a handful of larger Japanese cities so that they could test this new weapon. So by the time Hiroshima was bombed, it has a population of about 300,000. LeMay would have destroyed Hiroshima in July, right, a month and a half earlier, even as much as a month and a half earlier. Other than the fact that he'd been ordered not to. And so by the time Hiroshima takes place, he's burning these little tiny cities with virtually no industrial capability. And so he says, look, the heavy lifting had been done. I destroyed all of Japan's industry and its ability, you know. And so he knew the atomic bomb was going to overshadow all of his hard work to turn the bombing campaign around after Haywood Hansel. And of course, he's right. The atomic bomb does overshadow everything.
Black Snow is the book. Curtis LeMay, The Firebombing of Tokyo and the Road to the Atomic Bomb. Curtis LeMay, After the War. James Scott is the author. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.